We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello and welcome to Sordid Cinema. My name is Simon Howell. Ricky D is not with us today, but we do have Patrick Murphy.
Hey, Simon.
And I'm very pleased to announce we've got special guest, returning guest after a long, long absence. It's Eduardo Lucatero.
Hello.
Yay! So, if anyone's been listening to Sound on Sight or Sordid Cinema for a really, really long time, then you might have some idea what to expect. But Eduardo goes to Con every year because he's a fancy, fancy man. And and we used to get annual dispatches from you about Con. And we're going to do it again this year. The timing just worked out perfectly. So we are going to have a bit of a general Con chat followed by a review of the new film by James Gray. It's called The Lost City of Zed. We'll get there when we get there. But you know what? Like, let's just get right into it because there's a lot to talk about. Now, I don't know, Eduardo, like how I'm always confused about, like, you know, there's what everyone talks about with Con, and then there's like the actual experience of being there and what the actual conversation is sort of within its walls. So I'm curious about, like, this whole Netflix kerfuffle. Like, did the people that you were going to movies with actually care about any of this, or was that just pure, like, media fluff?
It was the first, let's say, 3 or 4 days, there was a big expectations because apparently they were considering retiring Okja and the merit stories from the lineup. Because of the French Union of Distributors, or some one of the French unions, that there are many unions and they are really powerful. So one of them was very upset about the fact that the festival had 2 Netflix titles in the competition. So there was a lot of talk about it the first 3 or 4 days, especially because Okja was there on the second day, if I remember properly. And during the first screening, at some point, someone booed at the Netflix logo.
they had projection issues as well, right? Which didn't help.
That was a big thing. But then after that, once the movie actually started, everyone was happy. Everyone loved it. And once it was known that some people have booed at the Netflix logo, I guess people felt really stupid, and then no one talked about it ever again. I mean, if you're gonna boo at something that's worth booing, not because of a logo, that seemed pretty crazy.
Well, on that subject, I mean, there's anyone who's heard you come on before, Eduardo, will know that you're an opinionated fellow, to say the least, and I've always appreciated that. So did you see anything boo-worthy?
No. This is my 11th year attending the festival, and this is probably the festival when I attended the least amount of movies. I was just counting before speaking to you, I only saw 13 movies this year. I was there working producing my next film, so actually I was in meetings and lots of parties. I went to an unusual amount of parties this year. So I didn't have the time to go to that many movies, because also I realized in the last couple of years most of the movies come out much everywhere, especially because of Netflix and other things. So I mean, there were other years that I would try to sneak up to like 6 or 7 movies in a day. And now I realize that that's kind of stupid. And But I prefer like hanging out with friends and drinking and having meetings and stuff like that. Because, yeah, pretty much everything ends up being seen.
It's kind of funny that you pointed out sort of the essential like stupidity of you know, of rebelling against Netflix and, you know, services like that, because they've made, you know, for better or worse, they've made such a vast catalog so much more accessible.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I understand the complaints from people who complain. I personally hate watching movies on a small screen. I can't do that. I won't watch a movie for the first time on TV. Like, I like to watch movies that I've seen before, that I enjoy, that it happened to be on Netflix and I happen to not to have something else to do. Then I'll sit and watch it. But on the other hand, I'm old. And there's everyone under 30, they just watch movies on Netflix, and that's the way it's going now. And as a filmmaker myself, so many people have watched my stuff because of Netflix. So it would be kind of selfish and stupid for me to say, oh, well, yeah, you're an idiot. You should have gone and seen it on a big screen when it was in one theater 5 years ago at 11 a.m. in the morning. So I understand. I understand everyone.
Well, it's still pretty remarkable, though, that you saw 13 movies and none of them were awful. Like, that's a pretty good, like, even for Khan, like, that's a pretty good run.
Yeah. I mean, I walked out only of two movies. And,
but they weren't awful.
Exactly. Not necessarily because they were awful, just that I was not that interested. One of them ended up winning the Grand Prix, which is kind of like the second place. This French movie called 120 Beats Per Minute, which is a study of AIDS in the 80s in Paris or something like that. It starts really, really well. But after a while, like, the characters are quite uninteresting, and the movie is like 2.5 hours or something like that. So once I realized where the whole thing was going, I really wasn't all that interested, and I walked out.
Mm-hmm. That was from the screenwriter of The Class, right?
Yeah, and it's really interesting in that sense, because it starts very similar to The Class. You have these people discussing, and it's very lively, and you feel like you are there. And they are going on these discussions about what to do, because the government is not responding to their pleas, and they're trying to stop the infection to grow larger and to become the epidemic that it became. But somewhere in after half an hour, you start into their personal life stories, and again, they're not really that interesting people. But then again, a lot of people loved it, and right away, right after the screening, people were saying this movie is going to win something, especially with a jury president like Almodovar, a gay movie with attractive, good-looking young men having sex on screen for sure is going to get an award, and it did. But
I saw a lot of people guessing it was going to take the Palm.
Yeah. And again, it wasn't bad exactly. It was just I didn't care. The other movie I walked out, it was an Iranian movie that also ended up winning an award for Un Certain Regard, one of the smaller sections. An Iranian movie called An Exemplar Man or something like that, which is the latest example of Iranian misery porn. And
A Man of Integrity, I think, is the English title.
Yeah.
Look, if any nation has a right to make misery porn.
I know, and that's the thing. You are like, okay, living in Iran must be awful. And it just piles on these horrible things that happen to this man who, as the title implies, he's trying to keep his integrity and being honest and not falling into corruption. And yeah, no.
It doesn't work out.
Well, it's not that it's awful, but it's just that I feel like I've seen that movie 500 million times before.
Yeah. Well, I would add that, like, personally, it's been a bit since I've seen, like, a new Iranian film, like, at least a year or two. But, like, the best Iranian films that I've seen kind of managed to avoid that through some mechanism or another.
Yeah, and on the other hand, I saw a movie at the Critics Week, which is this parallel section that is mostly about first films. And they had this movie called Tehran Taboo, which was a very strange movie because it was an animation. But it was a rotoscopy. Is that the term?
Rotoscope, yeah.
Yeah, it was a rotoscope animation. Of it was three or four stories of women in Iran who kind of control their lives and they enjoy having sex, and one of them is a prostitute, and it was really interesting in that sense because it talks about the same themes, corruption and repression and how life in Iran is horrible, but it managed to give it a very interesting twist. And other than a really, really, really bad ending, it was definitely an interesting movie. If you come across it, it's interesting to watch.
And did they actually manage to produce that in Iran?
Well, it was a German-Austrian co-production.
Okay.
So yeah, I assume they sneaked cameras and they did all the easy work in Iran, then all the money had to come afterwards from Austria and Germany.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. So I know that you and I have been fans of Yorgos Lanthimos for a long time. I mean, I remember seeing Dogtooth at the Festival de Nouveau Cinema, whatever year that was, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and getting there slightly late. So that I didn't get the, I missed a key piece of information, and I was so confused and yet so enthralled. And I've been following him very closely ever since. So I was quite jealous, as I always am, that you got to see a Killing of a Sacred Deer way before anyone I know ever will. So you got to tell me a bit about what that was like.
Yorgos Lanthimos is an amazing, amazing, amazing filmmaker, and this is a really, really, really good movie. It is probably his least interesting movie, but it is still fantastic. It's just comparing with his other movies. This is really, really good. I don't want to say much because I think that if you're familiar with his work, the least you know when you start watching the movie, the better. Like, I think definitely part of the why his movies are so interesting is that you get so little information and you have to build it in your head. And usually by half the movie, then you realize what the movie is going to be about. And that moment is always like, oh my God, this movie is going to be about so and so and so. So I would recommend you not to read anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
The reviews that I've read after, I think they say a lot. But suffice to say, it is literally a Greek tragedy in a modern setting. It is the usual really bizarre behavior, very strange people doing very strange things. And by the hour 10, then you realize what is really going on, and it's quite amazing.
I don't know anything about really the premise or even necessarily like the full cast. You did mention to me that Alicia Silverstone is in it, which I think is amazing.
She has one scene that it is hilarious. Because it is Alicia Silverstone, just her popping up in that movie. It's a very strange thing. And she plays the mother of this very strange kid. And she wants to, Yeah. I mean, honestly, most reviews say way too much about all the movies in general. And
yeah.
In this particular case, I do think that the least you know, the better. But Alicia Silverstone has one scene, and it's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I was going to be looking forward to it because, like, Twitter actually is one of my favorite ways to follow Khan because it's difficult for people to spoil a lot, and it's just like it's a nice way to get sort of like gut level reactions. And I just saw all the people pouring out of that movie, and they were all using different descriptors for it, which is like a sign of a lengthy list movie. Like, oh, it was hilarious. Oh, it was terrifying. Oh, it was so violent. Oh, or whatever.
In my case, like, I during the movie itself, I was like, oh, this is interesting. Oh, this is okay. Oh, Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman are great. Oh, that's Alicia Silverstone. But I wasn't really as excited as I was in previous movies. But the thing is that after I walked out of that movie, I couldn't stop thinking about it for the next 8 or 9 hours. And that's when I realized that it was quite fantastic. That 7 hours later, I was still like, wow. How did this happen? How did all these things? And it's really well done, and it has a lot of similarities filmmaking-wise with Under the Skin. I believe it's the same sound designer, the guy who did Under the Skin.
The sound design or the scoring?
The sound design.
Okay.
I don't know if the scoring too, but the sound design. Like, I read about that. I read that and I was like, oh, it totally makes sense. So that is one of the things that's really interesting as well. And everyone in the cast is really good. And it takes place in Dearborn or Detroit, a very small place. Maybe Patrick can help us. What's the name of that place?
Somewhere in Michigan. Dearborn is in Michigan, and so is Detroit. Dearborn would be the smaller place.
Yeah, I think it's Dearborn where it takes place. Or a very small, weird city like that, which is also very strange to have Yorgos Lanthimos and Nicole Kidman on a movie based in Dearborn. Why not?
So did you... So was that your favorite out of the competition entries you saw?
Loveless, the Russian film by Andrei Zygietnevsky, I've never been able to memorize his name. Maybe you can. I'm sure you can.
No,
what's his name?
No,
I'm not even going to take a shot at that one.
No. Everyone like that, like, they need to pull a Weirus Ethical and just come up with a one syllable name, like Joe.
Like a pitch up tongue, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Zivnevsky, I believe it is. Anyway, that movie was really, really good too. Also, most reviewers say way too much. I will just say that it's about this couple getting a divorce. And it is a horrible, horrible, horrible divorce. Like, these people are awful. And obviously, the film is not really about these people. It's about the entire country of Russia. And the female protagonist of this film is this gorgeous-looking woman who hates her husband, has a lover, and spends her time taking selfies and taking pictures of her food. So that can tell you a lot about her. It's just... Every 5 minutes, she takes out her phone and either takes a selfie or start taking pictures of her food. It's quite amazing. It's sad, depressing, really, really disturbing in a way. Like, it's a kind of a police procedural, and it has no hope. No hope whatsoever. Cold, cold, cold. You leave and you want to take a shower. But it was great.
so they stole Haneke's crown then.
Yeah, and it's funny you should mention that, because Haneke's movie, I think it was quite bad. It feels like The deadline for funding is next week. Man, let me grab just pages of this screenplay and the other one and the other one and the other one, smash it all together, send it, and that's it. Like, it's almost like a best of or a compilation of all his movies. A critique of bourgeois values. Ooh, very daring.
never
heard that. I mean, rich people are awful people. Wow, that's gonna be controversial. and most of the cast is really wasted. Like, for the first time ever, Isabelle Huppert kind of seems to be like a normal woman. Toby Jones, for some reason, is in the movie, and it could have been anyone else, but it's Toby Jones and Matthew Kasovitz and Jean-Louis Trintignant. And in the end, it's even kind of silly. Obviously, it's amazingly shot, and it's definitely interesting, but by the end, you're like, eh? It almost feels like a first film by someone who really likes Haneke. But, yeah. It was okay.
Yeah, I was reading about it and like hearing even that there were like these sort of Benny's Video style, I guess, like YouTube clips or whatever. It really did make it sound like it was sort of like the way that the last couple of Lars von Trier films have been kind of like you said, like kind of a greatest hits or a culmination thing. Like this sounded like a much smaller version of that, where it's like pulling from a lot of things, but it didn't seem to inspire much hatred or joy from anyone.
Number one, don't you ever say anything bad about Lars von Trier?
No, I'm not. I I love Lars, and I defended Nymphomaniac when no one else knew.
It's a great movie. It is a great movie, except for the last 40 seconds. It is a great movie. Lars von Trier, a Nymphomaniac. But yeah, this one, it's if you really like Haneke, you're gonna like it, because it's Haneke. I don't think he's gonna get any new fans. Especially, it feels a little bit preachy. Like,
Haneke,
oh,
preachy?
Young people spend.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Kids spend a lot of time with their phones. Oh god. Okay. Next.
There's no scolding like Austrian scolding.
Yeah, but remember, in this case, it's French, because now.
Oh, that's right.
The whole thing takes place in France. So. Yeah.
Was there? That's it. We should be thinking about getting to our review of the hour. Was there anything else that stood out in one way or another that you feel like people should know about before it starts making the rounds elsewhere?
Well, The Square, the movie that ended up winning.
Oh, you did see it?
No, I didn't see it, because they had like two screenings. Like apparently they finished the movie like a week before the festival. And they even submitted it as a work in progress, and they're going to remove like a good 15 minutes from the film. So
oh, really?
I didn't get to see it, but pretty much everyone I know who saw it was amazed. So,
right. This is from the director of False Majeure, which.
Exactly. He's a really interesting guy. So
my folks are going to be very happy to hear this, because I watched, I had a screener of False Majeure, and I brought it to the house because I thought it would be funny. And it was funny, because they were so angry at me. So I'm delighted to tell them about his victory.
And it has Elizabeth Moss. So, hey,
never a bad thing.
And what's his name? The guy from The Wire.
Dominic West, yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, Dominic West, though. So I did see both of them, like, walking around in Cannes, so that's always a good thing. That, oh, Dominic, hey, how are you?
did you actually do that?
No. It's really badly. It's never a good thing to talk to people like that. I was having breakfast one day, and Guillermo del Toro was just sitting next to me, having breakfast with Dario Argento. And I'm just like, I can't believe Guillermo del Toro is having breakfast with Dario Argento next to me. And I was talking to a friend. I was texting a friend, and he's like, please go get his autograph. Like, no. If there's something you don't do here, is just go and interrupt two people like that. And yeah, can I have your autograph?
Because you would hope that, you know, when you become a Del Toro or Argento level figure, Eduardo, you would hope to be treated with you know, with a bit of distance and respect.
Well, no, I mean, there's only so much you can say to someone. Say, oh, I love your work. Which is a great thing, and I've done it. And sometimes when it doesn't sound like stalking or that you're creepy, if you happen to be next to someone whose work you admire, you can say that, and that's fine. But if someone is putting food in their mouth or discussing very important things, which was the case, like I eavesdrop a little bit, and it's like, oh, they're talking about really interesting things. Why would I just go in and insert myself into a conversation?
I just had this image of Del Toro and Argento having somehow a really boring conversation, which to me would somehow be more interesting.
Oh no, they were talking about Suspiria and about some remastering they're doing for Phantom of Paradise. I think Del Toro is gonna be helping with that or something like that.
Well, we should be, yeah, like I said, we should be getting to affairs. Any closing remarks or anything if you had to describe Con to someone who's never been, or like to try to like get someone to go, what would be your elevator pitch?
As I said, in the old days, it was a great place to watch movies that otherwise you could never watch anywhere else. But now is the time to watch movies before anyone else. So before people spoil movies for you. I think one of the greatest things is to walk into a movie and not knowing anything about it, not knowing if it's good, not knowing if it's bad, not knowing who's on it. And this year, for example, in particular, I didn't even open the catalog. So I had no idea who was on the movies. I just know that, this is a director I like. It doesn't last 4 hours. Or if it does, I have to go to the bathroom before. And that's a great thing, because I do feel that if you watch a movie 6 or 7 months later, after all critics have seen it and after everyone has seen it, you lose something. People already have an idea of that movie, and whether you want it or not, that changes your own conception of that movie.
Yeah.
As opposed to just watching it for the first time with everyone else, and you have no idea what's going to happen. And it's always good too, just to see, to be there. If you love movies, just it is the Olympics of movies, and everyone around you works in movies and has something to do with movies, and you can talk about movies in a way you can't really do in other places, unless we are like you and I and like friends like this. Imagine that, but like 25,000 people or 30,000 people in the same city at the same time. So it is pretty cool.
All right. Well, it's funny that you should mention watching movies cold, because we're about to discuss a movie that I went into pretty much totally cold. And that's James Gray's The Lost City of Zed. Let's hear a clip.
To dream, to seek the unknown, to look for what is beautiful is its own reward. A man's reach should exceed his grasp. Or what's a heaven for?
You are the explorer? Give me a hand.
I wish to find a lost city.
What you seek is far greater than you ever imagined. It is your destiny.
I'll not know you when you return.
I know this is a sacrifice for all of us.
The environment's brutally difficult. The journey may well mean your life, but you could reclaim your family name.
Ain't nobody comes back from up there.
But we have never let fear determine our future.
What did you hope to achieve out here?
If we may find a hidden civilization, where one was considered impossible to exist, we may well write a whole new chapter in history. I call it Zed. It is there. And we must find it.
That was a clip from The Lost City of Zed, written and directed by James Gray, who you may know from movies such as Two Lovers and The Immigrant. And it stars Charlie Hunnam as Percy Fawcett, a real person. He was a British officer in 1905. The movie does take place over about three decades, so, you know, be prepared for that. Who gets tapped for a geographical survey to help determine the border between Brazil and Bolivia, and ends up on a much greater adventure trying to track down what he calls, of course, the Lost City of Zed, based on his discovery of some pottery deep in the Amazon. And, of course, there's plenty else going on in this movie, but we can sort of get there as we get there. Ed, since we were just talking about sort of, I guess, European audiences, James Gray is one of these guys who isn't necessarily that broadly discussed in America, but has like a, am I imagining that he has sort of a massive following in Europe?
Yeah, as I understand, he's huge in France. He's really respected in Italy, and in general, festivals in Europe love him. And so, yeah, certainly it's very strange because his movies are quite American. They're very American. Like, I feel that his movies are all about people trying to belong to groups, and people obsessed with their own social standing. Mm-hmm. And that I feel that is a particularly American thing. But maybe that's why he's so popular in Europe, because I see him as a good example of an American author.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, had you seen any of his films before, to your knowledge?
No, I wasn't familiar with Gray at all. I mean, I knew of some of his films, but I hadn't actually watched any of them. So this was my my first dive mm-hmm. into that. I'm going to check him out a little bit more just because I liked the way he handled himself for the most part in this. And it does have a very classic feel. It has a very old-fashioned feel to it, to the filmmaking, which I really, really liked.
Yeah. That's fascinating also to start with that one, because it's a movie so different from all his other movies. But yeah, that's true. It's a very classic. He's a very classic filmmaker.
It's interesting that you'd say it's different from his other movies in terms of scope. This is a movie that's doing a lot. I mean, the first hour is sort of his version of a Herzog Odyssey, like an Aguirre, The Wrath of God type film, with some, you know, very obvious parallels. And then there's also, you know, this World War One segment, and then the last segment of the film kind of does this whole other thing as well. It's doing a lot. I mean, it doesn't feel disjointed, but it is doing a lot of things. That being said, there are some specific images and some specific ideas that seem to call back directly to some of his other films. And I'm thinking specifically, of course, of the final shot of this film, which I don't want to talk about in too much detail, but it so closely echoes the last shot of The Immigrant that it makes it feel like the films are meant to be directly linked. And beyond, I don't have a specific thesis beyond that, but it does feel like there's a specific attempt at a sort of oeuvre or style building here. I guess I should sort of put my cards on the table by saying I really, really enjoyed this film. I found it for a film that's 140 minutes and, like I said, takes place over a long period of time and stars Charlie Hunnam. We can talk about that maybe more specifically later, but I was never bored. I think it's frequently quite just stunning to look at, in particular the book ending shots of the film. And of course the opening shot has a significance you don't grasp until much later, which I guess is in itself kind of a classic move. The acting across the board by people I don't generally care about was like quite strong. And I think on a thematic level, the film's sort of up to some interesting stuff as well. We can maybe talk about the characterization and how, you know, realistic it is. And I don't even necessarily mean how historically accurate it is, because there's sort of no way to assess that. I mean, based on the life that Percy Fawcett led, it's just it would be a work of incredible scholarship to try to mount something that you could call realistic in that sense. But I don't know. I just found the whole film to be kind of a stylistically and narratively kind of a breath of fresh air.
I had some problems with it narratively. I don't think he necessarily pulls off everything that he's going for. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I feel like this film could have been 3 hours. It would have been done much better if it were longer. It would have been more effective, I should say. If it were longer, I thought he was going for some, there was some David Lean-ish stuff in this, some themes, you know, of obsession that I think could have been handled more. I saw a lot of Lawrence of Arabia in this. Did anybody else get that vibe from this film?
It's funny that you mentioned that, since Pattinson, who's Robert Pattinson, who's also in the film, just played T.E. Lawrence for Herzog.
Right. But I think he really could have gone further. I needed to see more in order for certain things to be powerful. Because it is, even though it doesn't feel disjointed, you're right. And that's usually because there's a lot of absorbing stuff in here. The visuals alone will keep you absorbed, but it does jump around a lot. And I wanted to just linger a little bit more on stuff in order to have it actually have impact.
I agree. I think there were a few parts that were kind of boring. And if they had been either cut out or gone into more detail on that, the film would work better, certainly. Either being half an hour shorter or half an hour longer, it would have that epic air that he was aiming for at some point. I mean, certainly Lawrence of Arabia is also like a 3 hour long movie, right?
Right.
But yeah, I agree. I feel that there were a lot of things that were not really explained, but apparently, according to James Gray, that was always the point, that his whole thing was to build up to things and then pass on to the next one, in his own words. I don't know how good is that, but that's apparently what he was going for.
Well, and maybe that's a good place to talk about, like, where something I find so interesting about the movie is it has that classicist sort of feel. You mentioned David Lean. I think that's a great point of comparison. But it is scaled back in a sense. Like you do get the feeling like if this movie had been made in the 60s or 70s, it would have been 3.5 hours long. This comes in at a relatively trim 140 minutes, which again, for the amount of ground that it's covering, quite literally, is really not that long. And you do get the sense, like, for the sort of thematic ground being covered, and for the like the sheer amount of time being covered, it's a pretty restrained movie. And that's kind of Gray's whole thing. Like I think what I find refreshing about him is how, even when he's doing this film that should feel sort of big and majestic and sort of showboaty, it feels quite small. Even, he manages to find these sort of intimate spaces in the midst of this really big story. And I think that's really valuable. Like you can just imagine, like, the sort of overblown version of this movie made by countless other people.
He never really goes all epic, you know, with the jungle. He doesn't go all out. There are a few vista shots toward the beginning, but other than that, he never goes too grand with the scenery part of it. And that's what keeps it from feeling, it keeps it a little more intimate. The jungle shots, the, you know, exteriors are pretty, they're very restrained. And he doesn't, he doesn't shoot like a lush jungle either. So he's not going for some sort of romantic, fanciful adventure. This is a darker, everything seems to be sort of backlit and details are all really fuzzy in this jungle. You don't get this lush green out of everything. It's a much shadier jungle. And the characters in it are all shadier. I felt like he didn't show people's faces very often. Other than Sienna Miller, I noticed that every single shot, she was definitely front lit. But everybody else, they all have various degrees of shadows going over their face. Everything is kind of dark in this. I think he was going for kind of an oppressive jungle as opposed to, you know, an Indiana Jones style grand adventure that this guy was going on. This was, you know, something darker, like what was maybe going on inside his head.
So that's really interesting because it certainly is not a happy movie.
It's not a happy movie, but I do think it's a hopeful one, which like it's, I think another sort of point of delineation is when I was talking about sort of the Herzog comparison, like this is not a Herzogian jungle film at all. Like it doesn't have that antagonistic relationship to nature that Herzog had, which was, you know, obviously great and hilarious. But, you know, this movie has like a reverence for the jungle that Herzog obviously didn't. And also, you know, you were talking about, Patrick, this notion of obsession, and obsession is sort of like the ultimate movie theme. Like, you know, every like major auteur at some point has made a movie about obsession in one form or another. What I find interesting is that this movie almost like resists that. Like there is an obsessive element to Percy, and you know he does go on these three separate expeditions, but at the same time there's something very sort of grounded about him compared to like a Herzog sort of figure, where he does think about the practicalities of things. He does, and he has like an explicit mission that he has grounds for. Like he, it's not some, you know, Quixotian, like, absurd thing where, you know, he was looking for something that definitely didn't exist. Like, he had reason to believe the things that he did, and if the postscript of the film is to be believed, you know, he was right, and it would take another, you know, 8 decades for him to be vindicated. But I think that's sort of another thing that separates him from sort of other protagonists of that sort, where it's not a hopeless quest, and even despite the way that it ends, however sort of that's mounted, there's a level of reality and practicality that is different from, I guess, like an Aguirre type figure.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to see his obsession a little bit more, to tell you the truth, because I didn't really get what he was so intent on finding, why he was so curious about this. Why was he so interested in this? He wasn't an archaeologist by trade or anything like that. So what really inspired him to take all of these trips?
Fame and fortune,
I suppose. But at one point he had already pretty much elevated his standing and joined the National Geographic Society. And he had basically redeemed his family name to a certain extent. And yet he was still hell bent on discovering this place. And
But it's interesting because once there is one dinner that you feel that now he feels that, okay, I'm finally vindicated and my family is now as cool as the other families, and he's uncomfortable and he still feels like he doesn't belong. So I feel that that's why he keeps doing it, and he wants to rub it on everyone's noses that, yes, I was right.
Well,
that's how I feel it.
There's sort of this whole other layer to his character and to Sienna Miller's character as well, where there's an ideological element to his quest as well. And I don't know how, again, this is the notion of realism. I'm sure that these characters are whitewashed to a certain extent.
I don't think that we should trust any of this to be like his opinions in this movie to be the opinions of the actual Percy Fawcett. I looked into this quite extensively in research for this podcast. And the writings about him are all over the map. He's a racist. He's a friendly white man. He was everything in between. Everything's so sensationalized, and there's really very little reliable truth
right
out there.
So we should talk about like the narrative that Gray chooses. And it's a really interesting one. You know, it's this, he gets to toy with the limits of Fawcett's sort of enlightenment. I mean, yeah, this is a guy who in like 1905 and then up to like the 1920s, like has, according to the film, this is the only text we're going with, has these views about the natives of Amazonia, as he calls it, and how they're, you know, the British thought of them as just savages and people to be subjugated and like lesser beings is at least perhaps not correct. This is not a movie about people resisting him on that. There is some opposition to his ideas, but that's not what the movie ends up being about, which I also found really interesting. It doesn't become some quest for him to prove that, but he does have this this ahistorical element to his character where he's jutting against popular opinion. At the same time, there's that very pivotal sequence in the middle of the film where his wife, played by Sienna Miller, argues for coming with him on an expedition, and he absolutely will not hear of it. And you know, there's this,
she's a woman,
because she's a woman. Yes. Though that's the only reason, only real reason. And, and it's this great, like, I think it's a really like clever, it's a clever way to say like, yeah, just because, you know, these movements of progress don't always line up. And, you know, just because he has these ideas that, again, he may or may not have actually had, it doesn't mean he's necessarily going to believe in woman suffrage or anything like that. He has these he even says at one point, like, these are the orders on which our society has been built. Man does this, woman does this. Like, he sounds like a caveman. And it harshly cuts against everything else about his character. It's a really interesting portrait.
Well, it does. I mean, it's almost in line with his character in some ways, and because I'm not so sure that his opinions on the Amazonians are for any sort of social reasons, but other than maybe it's how he views himself. He's been looked down at his whole life and thought to be a lesser person because of either whatever his father did, which is implied that his dad was, you know, a gambler and in debt. Probably defaulted, which was a horrible thing in England back then. So he's been thought to be a lesser person, and he kind of loves the idea of proving rich snoots wrong in how they view other people, period. But the movie, I don't think he really cares about the natives whatsoever. You never get the impression that he's really into learning their culture or understanding them or caring about them at all, other than to prove some rich, you know, geographer, you know, some rich society people wrong.
Oh yeah, yeah. He even when he kind of befriends one of them, the word befriend is quite generous. Like it's he uses him. It's like, I'm gonna use you, and oh, your culture is so colorful. he's a total tourist. He's like a spring breaker in Mexico. Like, just like, oh, so many colors. But he doesn't give a fuck about any of the locals. I agree.
I mean, I think that's a little bit harsh. I mean, I think if you consider him in the context of the story, I think he's somewhere between what you're saying and having a form of respect. I think he does have a form of respect for them that is rare among these characters. I mean, there's a key sequence, maybe a little over halfway through the film, where they encounter a tribe of cannibals, which by the way got into some considerably gnarlier imagery than I was expecting from out of this movie. so props for that. And the variety of reactions just in that small group is really interesting. Like, there's total revulsion and almost mutiny. And he's just kind of, again, he's focused on his goal to the extent that he's willing to sort of to look past the apparent barbarism. He also, of course, he says that according to them, you know, they're only eating someone who had sort of already died.
But that kind of almost speaks to him just treating them as tools. He didn't care that they were eating anybody. He actually cared nothing at all about their civilization. He only cared about the information that they could provide him with, and whatever he had to put up with to get his information for his goal is all that was really important to him there. They could have been executing anybody for all he cared. It didn't matter that it was a bad person that they were eating. It wouldn't have mattered if it was somebody's, you know, loving mother. He just wanted to get the information, and he would have gladly partaken in whatever ritual he needed to, smearing her blood all over his face if he needed to. I just don't think he cared.
Yeah. It's like they're still eating people. So you can't just say, oh yeah, whatever.
He was a bad guy.
They were already dead or bad people. Yeah, it's like it's still pretty kind of incorrect to eat people. Let's just say it.
One thing I found interesting in the film's treatment of the natives is until the very end, you don't actually know what any of them are saying. You only hear through translation or they speak English. But in the end, there are actual subtitles. And I was wondering what the reason for that was, because he carries on many conversations with them in another language.
I mean, I think
often Spanish.
If I had to guess, I think it's about the shift in the balance of power. At that point, it's, you know, at that point, I don't want to get, you know, too much into, you know, speculation about what happens exactly. But at that point, you know, they're more or less entirely at their mercy. And I think it makes sense that they sort of take over the language of the film. I have to say, like, you can call it whatever you like, but that entire sequence where we're sort of getting intercut with whatever happens to them and these sort of flashback sequences with Sienna Miller's character and this voiceover, and God damn it, I'm sorry, but that really worked for me.
Oh, it was beautiful. It was beautiful.
I the end, I kind of conked out on. I don't think it was, I didn't find it to be overly emotional, if that's what you're getting at. I just kind of, I sort of appreciated what it was, but then as soon as the title card hit at the end there, not the title card, but the postscript, I was wondering how that last scene even, how they dreamed that one up. That was all I could think of, as opposed to any sort of powerful significance for the, for those moments.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a beautiful scene. It has a lot of relevance, but I wouldn't find it emotional. And as you say, it's very similar to the last scene of the immigrant, which again, it's gorgeous, but it's not necessarily that powerful. I mean, emotionally powerful, but it is so well shot and so like, how did they do that? Mm-hmm. That it pulls you in whether you want it or not.
Yeah, I personally found it quite, maybe it was because I saw it at a really late screening, and so I was like, it was just in the, like, I didn't end up leaving the theater until almost 1 a.m. I don't know, something about it just really got to me, and I think that, you know, we were talking about
did you
about
cry?
Yeah, obviously. Anyway, but I do that a lot lately. I mean, at movies.
And at television shows and at commercials and while walking on the street.
Yeah, just having a good cry. No, I did find the movie quite affecting in the end. And I think that, you know, we can talk about the effectiveness of this or not, but I don't think the movie's opinion of the character is as low as yours is. And I'm not sure it's entirely unearned. I mean, I think that, you know, he ends up going on this final expedition with his son. And there's at that point this real, it seems to be more about idealism than obsession. Like the Percy character has developed this notion of gaining experience that other men don't have, so that you can better understand the world around you. Because I think sort of the ultimate theme of the movie to me is people who are living sort of beyond their time, even if in some ways they are very much of it, and sort of the tensions that creates. To me, that's what the movie is about. I think in that sense, in sort of depicting these people who have real limitations and have real flaws, but sort of do have this inkling that they could do or be better and sort of urge society in that direction. You call it corny if you like, but I actually found that really affecting, and the way that the ending kind of plays into that sort of climactic sequence around the fire. I thought that was it really got to me. I don't know.
I think your assessment is dead on, but I just don't think that the film properly conveyed that to me. Let's put it that way. Like I say, I think it needed to be longer. I needed to see more of his motivations in order to truly be affected by what happened to him in the end. Because even though I did find this film absorbing, it was mostly for visual reasons. I really admired the filmmaking, and it kept pulling me in, just the general atmosphere of the film. I didn't find the characters compelling, but I found the film compelling, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but at the screening, at my screening, there was a Q&A with James Gray afterwards, and he was mentioning that perhaps all his movies are about the end of an era. And it really clicks with what you're saying right now, Simon, that, yeah, it feels like this is it, like it's over. And then there's not going to be any new discoveries later. There's the press is going to be different. The army is going to be different. Everything that he has worked in his life is changing. So this is kind of the last chance he has to do what he wants to do. And I think it's really interesting in that sense.
I've sort of glossed this over, but I really have to give props to a few people. First of all, you know, like I, I'm not the world's hugest Charlie Hunnam fan, but I really thought he did a pretty respectable job, in like what it's not the most like, it's not necessarily the most complex and layered role as written, but I think that, he did a more respectable job than I was expecting. And even more surprising was I really thought Sienna Miller was quite good. And I'm not sure that's a sentence I've ever said. I mean, I haven't seen her in that many films. I'm not trying to be an asshole. It's just she's never been memorable to me. And I thought she,
no.
I thought she was quite good. But man, I have to say,
yep.
Robert Pattinson is really carving out a nice little niche as a character actor. So good for him.
Yes. He had something going on with his character. He was able to convey a ton with very few lines. I found him to be fascinating in this movie. The most fascinating character. Hunnam did fine. I thought he did fine with the material that he had. But Pattinson did more than fine with the dearth of material that he had to work with.
And then he kind of gets lost, like, towards the second half of the movie. Like, kind of, you want more Pattinson? Again, something that no one had ever said before. where's Pattinson? I want more. And then he's kind of gone.
His position was just to clap or nod his head occasionally from the crowd whenever Hunnam was speaking. Yeah, I was taken slightly out of the film, though, when the Emperor walked in. That kind of threw me for a loop when Ian McDiarmid was the president of their society.
I honestly, that did not even click for me.
That voice is so burned into my brain for another role that seeing him as anything else is just tough for me. Takes me out of whatever movie I'd be watching. Mm-hmm.
The only other two people I wanted to specifically mention was, the score by Christopher Spellman is gorgeous. Holy crow. Like, I was really taken aback by it at several points. Was I the only one who noticed that?
No, I think it has to do with what we've said a few times, that this is a filmmaker who loves the classics and who seems to be always paying homage to, like, the great filmmakers of the bygone eras, and the score helps to do that. It's just certainly, it could be like a David Lean kind of thing or even a Herzog kind of score. Just, yeah, it's beautiful. I agree.
Yeah. The, I also wanted to mention the cinematography by Darius Kanji is just, obviously the book ending shots, as I mentioned, he's sort of he's his regular cinematographer, and they obviously have something special going. I guess more broadly, sort of, so we can sort of wrap things up, like, this is the kind of movie you don't see getting made a lot these days. Like, it has a budget of $30 million, what you might call like a medium budget movie. And I'm sure you've already read a think piece at some point or the other about how they don't make those anymore. You'll notice Brad Pitt in getting a production credit here. I don't know. It's like a non. Like, I mean, I just personally, like, really enjoyed the film, but more broadly, like, it's a non-insulting movie for adults, which is, like, You don't get a lot of those these days. And I don't mean to demean, you know, genre films and things like that that I obviously love, but it's so rare to get, like, you know, a historical drama like this that's made in a way that doesn't make you want to gouge your fucking eyes out.
Mm-hmm. What about Baywatch?
What's unfortunate is this film kind of just got dumped off, and even for a mid-budget movie, it was never really given a chance out there. Most people haven't even heard of it, which is really too bad, because this is the kind of movie that I think a wider audience could appreciate. I don't think it's so inaccessible that this couldn't have gotten out there. It is somewhat of an adventure movie. Yes, it's an adult movie, but these are the kind of movies that people used to enjoy going to see, and now that's not really an option anymore. And when an option does happen, they're never really even made aware of it.
It has been doing well, right? I mean, it has been playing in one or two theaters, but it has been playing for, what, 2 months now, 3 months?
I think almost two. It opened in April here anyway in the States.
Yeah, it's been making the rounds slowly. It has, according to Wikipedia, it's made $14.4 million so far, which is like pretty respectable considering it's probably going to keep playing, and I assume it's going to. I don't know if it's played internationally at all. I imagine it'll do quite well in Europe. I think he'll be all right. I think he'll be okay. I think the movie will be okay. I just think it's too bad that you know. Ed, you and I have talked so often about how, like, the worst movies aren't, like, you know, your, what am I thinking? They're not your Jack and Jills or, like, your, whatever.
They're not?
No, I mean, they're not, like, those movies are bad. But, no, to me, the worst movies are just the ones that were made, like, the middle brow, you know, general, like quasi-respectable, but really just, like, deeply... ideologically and on a script and performance level and a direction level, just flat and dull and with of no particular interest to anyone, and thereby of a little bit of interest to everyone, you know, like just general mush. And I think that Gray is an interesting guy because he makes movies that seemingly would be that, but they have a level of craft and thematic interest that to me just sort of like really. He distinguishes himself in a sort of like sphere that's really difficult to do that in.
Yeah, I agree. Like all those Academy Award hungry movies, they do really well when they come out, and then no one has any interest in watching them ever again. And this is the kind of movie that people are gonna watch, and they're going to try to get it on DVD, and they're going to try to watch it because there's something about it. There's something to talk about it.
Yeah. It's at least something that sticks. It's got meat. You're going to at least remember because there's something sort of haunting about it, even though, like I say, the plot itself, the story didn't really get to me and the character didn't get to me, but the film did. And I enjoyed it for that. I think it'll stay with people. It is something to talk about. It's something for them to speculate on. Because, you know, it's kind of an elliptical story. It's not really, it's not feeding you a whole lot. It is making you fill in a lot of those blanks. Granted, I said I would like a lot of those blanks filled in.
No, I think, and maybe that's what separates us, is I was perfectly happy to fill those in myself with my own, like, grandiose ideas of what the movie's about. And that seemingly that what I just did is what Gray wants us to do. So I guess I win. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, the movie's called The Lost City of Zed. Eduardo, I thought you might want a minute to tell us what your new project is that you're shopping around.
Oh, it is a big historic project, historic drama with a lot of sex. That's how I was talking to people in Cannes.
Really?
And everyone seemed interested, so yeah.
Is that all you can tell us?
Yes. I'm very, very early stages of development, so a lot of things can change.
That is very, very
but
cool.
Yeah, lots of nudity, historical drama.
But all the nudity is you, right?
Maybe I can write myself into it. That would be fun.
I just want to say, Eduardo, don't be one of those people that writes in lots of nudity, but there's no dicks on the screen. Have some balls. And put some balls and dicks on the screen.
Oh, there will be a lot because, well, you will see. You will see when it comes out.
All right, I'm holding you to that.
I'm picturing Caligula right now.
actually, I have a scene that's very similar to that scene in Caligula. Yes.
Okay. Now I'm gonna have to press you for details later off cast. Anyway, thank you, Eduardo, for joining us. Visit.
Thank you. That was fun.
Yeah. Do visit Sorted Cinema / Goomba Stomp. If you have any interest in Twin Peaks, also check out the podcast that I co-host with Kate Rennebaum. It's called The Lodgers, and I've also written some things on that subject recently. And of course, rate and review and subscribe to the show on iTunes. We could always use a little bit of a boost that way. And thank you all so much for listening. Kiss from